The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
So Tom Honig, 20 years ago, was taking over the job of the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. I remember the first time I met him, it was at the Jackson Hole Symposium, which is sponsored by the Kansas City Fed every year. He was really new in the job then. He agreed to an interview. 20 years later, he said, Kathleen, you got the first one, you get the last one. Tom, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here with you once again.
Well, thank you, Tom. What a 20 years it's been. What was it like? I mean, you had started at the Fed. You're 18 years before.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like taking over as president in 1992? Were you kind of eager and looking forward to it? You a little bit nervous about how you're going to do becoming one of the top guys, a Fed official?
All the above. Certainly excited and pleased that the board of directors of this bank had confidence in me. And nervous, big responsibility. But I felt very comfortable, if that's the right word, in taking on the responsibility. I've had lots of training in crisis management, for example. And I had great mentors who taught me and prepared me. And so I felt very, very good. Now, a little bit of fear, but fear is a very good motivator, as we all know. And the combination gave me the determination to get started.
Well, and determination is important. I want to talk a little bit more about your background. You're a Midwesterner. You grew up in Iowa, Kansas City. This 10th Federal Reserve District goes west from western Missouri to Wyoming, south from Nebraska to New Mexico. You grew up in Fort Madison. You attended Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
You worked on the Santa Fe Railway and the Summer Stream Communications Lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is really your base. This is really what shaped you. What did this upbringing, what did it mean growing up here to who you are now?
Oh, it meant everything. In a sense, you are the sum of your experiences in so many ways. But I come from a rural area. Fort Madison is a big metropolis of 13,000 people. My grandfather farmed. My father was a plumber and owned a plumbing construction company. I tell people he put me to work officially when I was 9 years old to take inventory. That's when I learned to count. But I also watched how he did his business through good times and bad. In good times, he helped build new plants, and in bad times, he helped maintain what was there. But I think the other thing I learned was in the 70s when he had his business, and I saw how difficult it was for him to bid jobs and so forth with an inflationary environment that we had. You remember those things like so many others. And so all that background, I saw what debt did to companies growing up because my dad was in the business and watched. So you learn all those experiences, and it does shape you, shapes your attitude towards what it takes to grow, savings as much as borrowing, and these sorts of things. So, yes, it had a tremendous influence on me.
The neighbor who gave you the 500,000 mark note, tell us about that.
Well, when I was named president in 1971, he lived literally right next door to me, and his name was Norman Westheimer. And he said, Tom, I was in Germany in the early 20s when their hyperinflation took hold. And I remember it vividly to this day. And he was around 83 at the time. And he said, I kept this note, and I'm giving it to you as a reminder that the protection of the value of the currency is your principal responsibility. Yes, all these other things, but that's your principal responsibility. And his words were, and don't you ever forget it. And I framed that note, and I remind anyone who will listen about the meaning of that note. And it's been, it also has influenced me.
Now, of course, when you joined the bank, as you self-described, rookie economist, you didn't go to work on the monetary policy side, the banking side, bank examination. You were researching mergers and acquisitions and their impact on competition.
Correct.
That also had a big, big influence you, the farm crisis, people losing their land at that time period.
Well, you saw the beginnings of some of the mergers and acquisitions and some of the desire to take on more leverage and more debt to grow and expand in an environment where the price could never go down. And then I saw the aftermath of that in energy and in agriculture and in real estate and the devastation to communities and the banks that failed and the tragedy and the lives lost. It really shapes your experiences going forward. Yes, it was a tremendous experience being in that division, in that world, not just the theoretics of economics, but the reality of life.
Mm. The theoretics of economics, the practice, the reality, this really does fast forward us to right now, because these are some of the big questions hanging with the Federal Reserve as they've taken extraordinary measures to try to get a sluggish economy moving ahead, get unemployment down. Tom feels very strongly that some of these steps are the wrong steps. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more next on the Hayes Advantage on Bloomberg Radio. And as I will remind my listeners again, 20 years ago, Tom was just taken over as president of the Kansas City Fed. I was in high school, ha ha ha, and we sat down for Tom's first interview. Here we are 20 years later. It's so great to be back. And again, I want to thank Diane Raley, Tom's right-hand person, for helping set this up, Bill Medley as well, and all the staff for making us so welcome again at the Kansas City Fed. Tom, policy. Big dissension at the Fed. We can only imagine that if you were a voting member this year, you would have joined the other three dissenters recently in dissenting against what? The decision to keep the key rate at zero for 2 years if the economy remains weak, to do Operation Twist. Am I making the right assumption?
Well, I except for one little thing, they probably would have been joining me.
Right. There you go. Eight times last year, you put your foot down. You made your view clear.
It's a fair assumption. I do have concerns when you try and use monetary policy to solve every little problem, and when the markets and individuals begin to think of money as capital and money as a substitute for savings and so forth that are also necessary for a strong economy, I think you can get some bad outcomes, and that's what worries me. You've heard me say this, Kathleen, many times. I can't think of a product or a service or anything that trades well at zero. I can't imagine that credit does either, even some part of it. Not only that, but when you then start working to redefine the yield curve around a central planner's best views of how things ought to work, I think you then introduce new complexities and risk new unintended consequences, flattening the yield curve. The idea is to drive you into higher risk, but what about the other consequences of doing that? What are they? And so forth. So I have real concerns about trying to fine-tune and micromanage an economy when monetary policy is a blunt tool that is best kept as an overarching tool for the economy, not a micromanaging instrument or scalpel.
What about the economy? At the beginning of the year, you were looking for growth of 3.5 to 4%. There was a sizable body of people who were in that somewhat more optimistic camp. Many things happened, including the Japanese disaster, which hit the auto supply chain. We had some extremely bad weather in the Midwest. In the fall, we had the debt ceiling debate and the downgrade. Nevertheless, the economy's not growing that fast. Unemployment's above 9%. The camp that says the Fed must take whatever measure it can is saying, look, even if this has a small positive benefit right now at a time when the economy is hobbled by the aftermath of the financial crisis, the Fed should do it.
Well, I understand it, and we're all well-intentioned here. This is the goal, is to try and improve things. But a marginal, very small marginal benefit, maybe, and frankly, I'm not convinced you even get a small marginal benefit, but maybe, against what long-term consequences, what more serious consequences that you might invite. And my example is that in 2003, you've heard me say this perhaps, when the unemployment rate was 6.5% and we had to do something, and we brought interest rates down from 1.25% to 1%, left them there for a year, even when we had some recovery and growth. What was the consequence of that? A credit expansion, maybe even a bubble that eventually led to unemployment of above 10%. So what are we thinking about in terms of 3 or 4 or 5 years from now or 6 years from now? I think we risk further imbalances. I think history is on my side on that. People say, well, you know, there's no inflation. I say, there is no real inflation right now of the 5 and 6, but it's moving up. But even that's not my main concern. My main concern is the disallocation and the misallocation of resources that comes with a policy that's even on the margin may help a little, but what are the long-term consequences of that? I think we ought to be very, very humble in our expectations of what we can do with this instrument called monetary policy in an environment where we are a world of awash in leverage and debt that needs to be done, a country, the United States, that's consumed more than it's produced for 2 decades. We need to think about some other policies.
Well, like what? What should we be thinking about?
Well, I've said over and over again that left a real opportunity on the table with Simpson-Bowles, or Bowles-Simpson, depending on your politics, last year. But it was bipartisan. It was a commission plan that was generational-oriented, that had a proposal to deal with the deficit, the debt, tax reform, spending reform. If we had taken that seriously, think of the confidence we would have instilled into our economy that would, I think, have carried us forward. And I use the example when people say today, and they think, we don't know, but they think there may be a plan coming for Europe, the market accelerates. Imagine if you actually had a plan like Simpson-Bowles that led you, showed you a path, a generational path to the future. I think this economy would spark, and I think people would feel more confident and begin to really think about investment in productive goods. And jobs follow production, in my opinion.
Well, that leads us, I think, to another reason for saying the Fed should do more, because Congress isn't doing much, and if they don't, we'll get these big, severe automatic spending cuts, so that you need a loose monetary policy. A fiscal policy is going to get tight.
That's a false path, I think. Here's why. If you think about it, it is not in our best interest to flood this economy with more and more money. If I thought it would, I'd flood it. But what are you get these new bubbles that then we have to deal with later and so forth. And I don't know. People say, well, with greater deficit, you have more output. Well, that's correlation, but is that cause and effect? Probably not.
We're going to continue our conversation with Tom Hanek, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. We are at the Kansas City Fed in Kansas City, Missouri. What about calls for the Fed promoting higher inflation to bring down unemployment? That's next on Bloomberg Radio. Totally focused on my interview with Tom Hanek. He's president of the Kansas City Fed. A couple more days here at the helm, and then he's off to his next adventure. But he's taking time out for an in-depth discussion with us. The Hayes Advantage, brought to you by PowerShares QQQ. Visit PowerShares.com for up-to-the-minute ETF holdings, pricing, and trading information. Invesco PowerShares, leading the intelligent ETF revolution. And again, I just want to paint the picture again. Here we are. We've got the Missouri River. What, to our right, Tom, sort of?
Well, it's actually straight ahead.
Straight ahead? We just can't see it. Uh-huh. And downtown, the Liberty Memorial, the World War I Memorial,
correct,
the beautiful Union Station. You're on the board at Union Station.
I am, as a matter of fact. I have been. As they've restored it, brought it back, it's become a center for the city. It's a wonderful, wonderful place.
And I think, again, to give people a sense of where we are, you know, all the railroad cars, mm-hmm, all the shipments of, mm-hmm, agricultural goods, manufactured goods, so much passes through here.
Well, Kansas City was, you know, started in a sense as a railroad hub from the west, the south, and then back east and so forth. And it really did build through there. We have the Kansas City Southern Railroads is headquartered here, but we have Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, that comes through here. That's who I worked for when I was much younger. And it really is. And now, you know, this railroad goes into Mexico and they bring up to here. Then it's redistributed out. That's just one of the areas. We have Sprint here. We have Hallmark Cards. It's just a very important center of the United States and center of the Midwest.
What is the unemployment rate in Missouri right now?
Well, it's around 8% because Missouri is it's a little higher than 8%, actually, because Missouri is a manufacturing state. and it has suffered like the rest of the nation around that. But right now it's improving about on the same pace as the nation as a whole. But our difference is, and there is a difference in this region, is number one, agriculture, which is booming. And we were talking about land prices, and they are accelerating. And it's also an energy center for this part of the world. And it is, of course, doing extremely well, oil particularly, not so much natural gas. And that, of course, gives us an extra boost. And we've seen the effects of that in terms of the land values and some of the asset values that we are seeing paid for.
Is it your view that that increase in land values is driven mostly by the fact that agricultural prices are up and there's a lot of demand and a sense that not just in the U.S. but globally agricultural prices are going to continue to rise?
Well, who knows? I don't speculate, so I don't know where agricultural prices will go, but certainly we have had an increase in ag prices of some significance. Corn and wheat particularly, you've seen at historic highs, $7-$8, beans the same way. The other thing that, of course, is affecting land prices is long-term interest rates are at historic lows, and what we call the cap rates, the discount rates on this land, are also at historic lows. And your ability to expand, borrow against the land you may already own has facilitated the demand for land and accelerated this boom in land.
Do you feel like this is a consequence of the Fed's provisional liquidity, keeping monetary policy low? Do you think that plays a role, or is that secondary?
I think it's a contributing factor. It is, I wouldn't say secondary. I'd say it's an important factor, along with the increase in ag prices themselves and the demand. But of course, the demand globally has been in a sense spurred by a very strong provision of the world's reserve currency called the dollar that has exploded and helped create that demand back. And we're seeing the effects of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting that right now, you said earlier, and I can get a sense of this in your remarks now, that there is a concern about rising prices on your part. Is a concern about excess liquidity on this monetary accommodation, key rate at zero for so long, perhaps leading to, we're seeing it maybe bubbling up a little bit in ag mm-hmm. prices now, but it could be more later. On the other hand, there are economists talking about the need for the Fed to at least allow more inflation, if not target more inflation, mm-hmm. as a means to get unemployment down. For example, Charles Evans, the president of Chicago mm-hmm. Fed, said the Fed could target a level for unemployment, maybe 7.5% or 7%, and then let everybody know that, hey, it'll be okay if the inflation rate goes over the target for a while, maybe mm-hmm. up to 3%. I love what Vince Reinhardt said, former head of the Division mm-hmm. of Monetary sure. Affairs at the Board of Governors, going to Morgan Stanley now to be their chief economist. He says it's gone from whip inflation now, to generate inflation now. What do you think of that, Tom?
I think that is a terrible policy. I can't describe it otherwise. It is the policy that we did attempt in the 70s, the central banks around the world, to, you know, it was never really to generate inflation, but it was always to generate jobs. And the consequence of inflation is a reasonable price to pay, they argued. It sounds like the same argument to me, and I am pretty confident you'll get the same outcome. Very high inflation, out of control. No real generation of jobs, and in the end, a very serious correction that will be required for that, and more, if you will, bad outcomes. I just can't believe that we think that we would think like that as economists.
Larry Meyer, former Fed governor, said at a Bloomberg Link conference a couple weeks ago where I was moderating, he said, I would be asking my colleagues why they are so obsessed about inflation. The focus must shift from inflation to unemployment. And I think we come back also to the argument in the book by Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart. This time it's different. This is not a business cycle recession. We had a financial collapse nearly, and that is going to, the legacy lives on and on and on. And Ken Rogoff is another one who is pretty much arguing for the Fed to target a higher inflation rate.
Well, good luck. I mean, have fun with it, because you're going to suffer greatly. And, of course, it's usually the poorest who suffer the most, because, remember, inflation is a very regressive tax and affects those who are on either fixed income or are unable to hedge against the inflation, which is usually your poor members of your society, and all for what? Because you're going to you think you're going to get unemployment down, but what happened in the 70s? We had stagflation, for crying out loud, high unemployment, high inflation. I just don't see that. You know, an economy works best from a position of strength, which means we have leverage. We need to work it off. We need to think about that. Yes, there is a transition to get there. Let's go through it. Let's strengthen ourselves. Let's improve our debt positions. And let's lower the cost of real capital so that people are willing to invest here. You know, you cannot pretend that you're going to have more jobs because you create more and print more money. Jobs are created when you produce things. People say you want to create jobs. I want to create jobs. How do you do that? You produce either goods or services. Then you need people to help increase that production. You can't do that by inflating and undermining the strength of your economy. You can't undo that by creating even more leverage. And what you're doing in part with this inflation is, of course, there's two ways you solve your debt problem. One is you amortize it and you pay it off. The other is you inflate it. And that's what they're proposing, and I think it's a bad proposal.
We're going to talk more with Tom Honig, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Tom's other passion is banks that are too big to fail. He says this is undermining capitalism. Find out why next on the Hayes Advantage on Bloomberg Radio. Very much live at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City with Tom Honig, president of the Kansas City Fed since 1992. Started working at the Fed in 1973, right, Tom?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was actually the fall of 91.
Okay. Oh, there. Okay, well, I'm miscounting. Yeah. And here you are. Two days left.
Yeah, 2 days. And then they boot me out.
Yeah, because you turned 55.
Yeah, yeah.
Well. 65.
Who's counting?
Exactly. As far as 65 is the new 42.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
I want to get to you in a minute about some of your thoughts about what happens next. But first, I promise we talk about banks.
Uh-huh.
Because too big to fail banks is something that you have talked about, and not just in the banking crisis. I think, because what's interesting, let me pause and say something. What's interesting to you about you, Tom, is, again, for a long time, it seemed to me that you were a consensus person. Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Fed when you came on board, but you had worked under Paul Volcker, mm-hmm. in effect, right? Now you've worked with Ben Bernanke, and you really started stepping out in the financial crisis. And I think one of the ways that you really did was your adamant position on banks that are too big to fail and what should be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, and first of all, I had raised concerns in the 90s after the last crisis.
And well, in fact, thank you for reminding me, February 1996, you have mm-hmm. a big speech you gave, mm-hmm. and another one then that was in Davos, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, 1996 was in Davos, and 1999 was in Prague, Czechoslovakia, well, Czech Republic then, and it was because I had gone through the crisis and I'd seen what happens when the incentives are wrong, that I raised concerns. And so it was pretty much ignored. Not pretty much, it was totally ignored. And then we came into this crisis, and what I had witnessed was pretty much what I thought would happen. And so I felt more, I would say, a greater responsibility to say enough is enough and here's the issues. And it's not that I have anything against large or big by itself. It's the incentives, the protections that come around that, and the subsidy that implies, that gives those institutions, I think, a big advantage and also risks the economy more broadly. So that it's not arbitrary that I have that position, but based on experience of what comes with that.
And you shut down hundreds of banks, or helped shut them down, in when you came to the Kansas City Fed in the 70s, right?
Right. I did, and they were, you know, based on the fact that they had felt that, first of all, they could get deposits, and we had brokered deposits, so they could get sources of funds. Then they felt that, you know, they really did feel that the ag boom would continue, or the energy boom, and they're overinvested in those sectors or overloaned in those sectors. But at least in those instances, those banks that did, and not all banks by any stretch of the imagination did in this region, but those that did were allowed to fail or done purchase and assumptions were sold off in pieces. And the thing about that, Kathleen, is when you look at some of the banks today in the areas that were struck, Oklahoma, for example, or Colorado, they still remember those days, and they were much more prudent this time around. But in those instances where there were no consequences, even then, that banks were too big to fail, that creditors were bailed out over and over again, then you introduce those incentives. But you, what was worse in 1999 was you took the commercial banking industry that had the FDIC insurance and access to the discount window, and you allowed them to engage in high-risk investment banking, trading, hedge fund activities, and still have access to the safety net and the lower cost of capital. So they blew their balance sheets up. They leveraged them from 15 to 1 to 30 to 1 or 28 to 1 or whatever the number was, and increased the risk exposure across America and concentrated it even more. These institutions became a larger share of the market and control of assets, and the consequence was a worse financial crisis than I think we might have otherwise had. And that's unfortunate for America and for the world.
Dodd-Frank, the financial regulatory overhaul, in your view, does not solve the problem of too big to fail. In fact, you're extra concerned about SIFIs, the systemically important right. financial institutions, of which we would say put J.P. Morgan, B of A, Citi, sure. all the rest of us sure. on that list.
Sure. I mean, it's well-intentioned, I understand. But the question you have to ask, have you changed the incentives, really? In other words, you still have the safety net. Everyone knows you're going to lend to them in a crisis. Creditors know they're going to be able to bail. The odds are very high.
But you're
high.
Going to have a resolution authority now, Tom. Well, people have to create living wills. That's the argument, right? We've got the mechanism in place, which we didn't have, and we'll do it this time. That's the argument.
Well, number one, we call it resolution. And we can force them to sell off this activities if it threatens the institution. You know, we had that with the Bank Holding Company Act in 1970. You know how many times it was used over the 30, 40-year period? Maybe zero mm-hmm. is a close number. And it, for example, when times are good, who's going to have the ability to require these institutions to sell off activities that might jeopardize them in the future? It just doesn't happen that way. And when times are really bad, who's going to buy this stuff? So you don't have the mechanisms to force these high-risk activities out in good times nor in bad times, so they won't get spun out. Then you say, well, in the times we'll resolve them in a very straightforward way. But think about it. You have Thursday, Friday, the liquidity crisis comes. You have Saturday to find a solution. Sunday night, the markets in Asia open. And what do you have? Is it really a solvency problem? Or is it a liquidity problem? And you're the Secretary of Treasury of the United States, and you have to make that decision. And guess who your boss is? And guess where all the influence lies? You are going to have a liquidity problem every time. And then you're going to say, well, later we'll sort it out. But by then, you're in for a penny, in for a pound. And you are not going to be able to unwind these institutions easily or take them into receivership. And the consequences, as soon as you say you have a liquidity problem, anyone who has any doubt that you hold that will be running for the hills, and you're going to be funding that excess before you can take it into resolution. I just think it is inherently flawed because you still have the same incentives around the safety net. You haven't spun out the high-risk activities, so you are bound to repeat the same events. I don't know when, 2 years from now, 20 years from now, but you are bound to repeat them.
How do you fix it? If we had this contentious, but 2,000 or 5,000 page Dodd-Frank overhaul, if that hasn't done it, what needs to be done? What can be done? Or do we just have to live with this?
Well, we don't have to live with anything. We can make changes. What I have suggested is to strengthen the Volcker Rule. I have the highest regard for Paul Volcker. He lived those days in the 80s more than I did. He knows that we need to separate out these high-risk activities from the safety net. And that's at least a start. That's not going to solve all the problems. It's not going to end large institutions. But it begins to separate out the high-risk, make it less likely you'll have the crisis, make it a little more able to deal with the crisis when it comes. It also, I think, will inhibit the wild growth and leverage of some of these institutions.
I can just hear Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, saying, Tom, you're wrong. We are well run. We're one of the most efficient. You just don't understand. We have to compete globally. We bring efficiencies to the market. We give consumers and businesses the benefit of our economies of scale.
Well, I would say I very much appreciate the fact that you say that. I don't think in this last crisis, I think they were running for the hills as much as anyone was. I saw liquidity dry up in this part of the country in a minute, and I don't remember them being there making those loans. Number two, I think they are still highly leveraged. And I look at capital the old-fashioned way. It's called equity. It's called book value capital. It's what's there that can absorb the loss. And when you look at it, if those institutions have an equity to asset ratio of 5%, that's a 20-to-1 leverage ratio. That's pretty high leverage. Margin of error is still, I think, fairly thin. As far as efficiency goes, if they're that efficient, they don't need to have the safety net. Are they really willing to give it up? Access to the discount window, federal deposit insurance, especially in a crisis when you put the guarantees around it? I doubt it. So all I'm saying is separate out your high-risk activities. Move it back out of their bank. You are responsible, Jamie Dimon, for the payment system. You are a major participant in the payment system, the safety of that payment system, and the intermediation process. And that is a lot of risk right there. And let's focus on that. And I think I think the country will be better off.
Any chance that happens anytime soon?
I don't see it in the outlook, no. I think people want to put that behind them. They want Dodd-Frank is done and let's move on to something else. But I think we have to be considering it today, have to think about it, anticipate it, because if it does occur again, or perhaps when it does occur again, we're in a position to deal with it.
European debt crisis. Do you see any parallels what's happening in Europe to what happened because of the excessive risk-taking and the lack of curbs?
I think that makes a point, and that is we need to be competitive with the rest of the world. There's two ways to compete, to the top and to the bottom. And when you are in a business where you have these large institutions with this great safety net, with the ability to leverage up, you compete for increasing amounts of risk. So, yeah, we competed with Europe or wherever it is, and we're now both suffering from it. I think the greatest ability to compete globally is from a position of strength, high capital ratios, well-managed institutions that are able to make calculated risk decisions and not based on their trading book or whether it's going to move 20 basis points today or not, but what their portfolio of lending is to companies, manufacturing and others in this country. Doesn't mean that we don't need investment banks at all. We need them. We need the high risk. We need the entrepreneurial ability to generate new activities. But that is a little different business. It's a big different business. And we need to recognize that and not give everyone access to the safety net to create an unmanageable risk around the country. And we gave them that safety net, remember, over the payment system and the stability of that banking core business.
We're going to continue our conversation with Tom Honig, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. As I said, 20 years on the job. He's getting ready to move on to his next life. We're going to find out more about what might lie ahead, what Tom sees on the Hays Advantage on Bloomberg Radio. I want to use every single second I can now with Tom Honig, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, as we continue to talk about the big issues and we've reminisced a bit today, Tom,
sure.
Haven't we?
Yeah.
Gosh.
We have.
Yes, we have. And again, and so what's next? I think you have such a passion for these issues. You're very clear now. You have definitely stepped into the spotlight more with your views. Where are you going next?
Well, I don't know for sure. As we said at the beginning, I'll take a little bit of time off here. My wife and I are going for a little trip. But I hope to stay. I'd like to stay in public service. I think it's what I've done. I care about the country a great deal, and I care about banking and finance. I'm And I mean large as well as small institutions. I think they're very essential to a strong economy. So I'd like to stay in that area. But at the same time, I can hopefully influence in other matters. I've talked about different opportunities in teaching or in different realms. So I will – I don't have the we like to say I don't have a nameplate kind of figured out yet, but I've got it prioritized, put it that way.
Okay, and I just have to share yet another comment from a listener who tweeted me earlier today along the lines of, with the country in a time of peril, would you consider taking an appointed position like Secretary of the Treasury?
Well, first of all, that's very flattering. I mean, that's the only thing you can say. And the only way I can answer that is if asked, I would serve. But I'm not going to wait by the phone by any means. But it's, I mean, to serve this country is what I've spent 38 years doing, and it's what I care about. So in any way I can serve the country, I would.
Well, certainly politics, the Fed, those are that's a thing that's out there right now. And I think there's a view that maybe the Fed, since the financial crisis, is sort of been on the defensive, keeping its head down a little bit, right? Waiting to see how the Dodd-Frank legislation would be written and what powers it would or wouldn't take away from the Fed. And you have been a dissenter against quantitative easing and some of these other measures. When you see the GOP leadership, for example, on the same day the Fed is meeting, putting out an op-ed saying, don't do any more excessive steps, does that concern you? Are you worried that maybe even you contributed to an atmosphere where people feel like the Fed is fair game?
No, it doesn't bother me. The Fed has been fair game since 1913. I think it was, the law was signed on December 24th, and I think the first complaint was December 25th on Christmas. It's part of America. And, you know, we just put out a little book called The Fed Under Pressure, or Under Pressure, and it talks about the...
I've got it right here. Under Pressure, Politics in the Federal Reserve During the 90-91 Recession.
Right.
So basically when you were coming on board 20 years ago.
When I was coming on board. And things, I mean, that's the nature of being a central bank. And the reason you're given what I call semi-autonomy, not complete independence, because we are always accountable to the Congress, is to allow you to look to the long run, to get through the political pressures that will inevitably come, and be able to act in the long run best interest of the country. And I was once told by a Swiss central banker many years ago when I was stepping into it that you are paid to think of the long run so that the short run can take care of itself. And if you lose sight of the long run, you begin to get tangled into short run decision making that I think hurts the economy. So I hope we're looking at the long run. We have different views. That's the other beauty of the Federal Reserve. You have different perspectives that come to the table, and that's what we have to keep in front of us.
And how about Barney Frank's Democrat from Massachusetts, leader on the House Financial Services Committee, view that Fed Bank president shouldn't have a vote?
Well, I think that's very ill-advised. I strongly disagree with him on that. And let me give you my, you know, he was arguing that it would be more democratic, and I'm very careful. And I don't mean to offend, but I think there's a difference between political and democratic. And I think if you consider how I was selected and how my successor was selected from a broad base of individuals, rancher in Wyoming, bookseller in Oklahoma, entrepreneur in Colorado, manufacturer in Kansas City, and they went through a very rigorous 150 people to start with interviews. And then they selected who they thought was best for this region, and they're all from this region. And then you think of politics, and I say this, and I say it understanding I may offend, I hope not, but we had a president, a Democratic president, who had a Secretary of the Treasury who had been the former chairman of Goldman Sachs. We had a Republican president whose Secretary of the Treasury just happened to be a chairman of Goldman Sachs. They also are major contributors to both parties. I think that's political. I'm not saying they weren't well qualified at all, but that's political. Ours, I think, relatively speaking, is fundamentally more democratic, and I certainly wouldn't change it. And the regional input that comes into the policy that I hear around this region, in Denver, in Oklahoma City, in Omaha, in Wichita, Kansas City, grassroots input, I think is important to understanding in the communities how monetary policy is conducted and to explaining it back to them. You can't do that with a politicized institution.
Got a little surprise for you. You have to put on the headphones. So I've got my headphones on. Tom doesn't, because we've got somebody on the line who wants to say hello. Al, go ahead.
Hi, Tom. Al brought us here.
Oh, hi, Al. How are you?
I'm doing
good to hear from
you. I hope you are.
I am fine.
Let me just add my congratulations to all the many others I know you've received. You've been a fabulous contributor to the Fed and Fed policy. I greatly enjoyed working with you in the years we were together there, and I've been following you ever since.
So, well, thank you very much, Al.
God
it's
bless
good to
good
hear from you.
And
well, and you set the standard, let me just say.
Oh, hardly.
Well, Al, you can hang. I have to, another question I wanted to squeeze in here with Tom Hahn and put him on the spot. You worked for Paul Volcker, you worked for Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke. Who really sets the standard for you when it comes to Fed chairman?
Well, I'm going to be very diplomatic here. They're all wonderful, first-rate individuals. But, of course, Paul Volcker is the person I worked through the crisis with and who brought down inflation, took the great, and who I look to as first among equals. I don't hesitate to say that. I think the man is a great American.
Any final thoughts, Tom?
Well, I would say to those who have listened to me over the years, I appreciate it very much. Those who have disagreed with me, I very much appreciate that, because it's what how we get to the right solutions is through dialogue. And don't just forget me. I may come back in a worse form than ever.
Well, let's hope so. Tom Hahnig, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been good to be with you. Thank you, Al Broadus.
And we're gonna you're gonna leave the Fed, and then you can come do the show, right, Tom?
Oh, of course.
Guest host and all. Yeah. Okay. Oh. Many thanks to Tom Hahnig, right. President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. A couple more days at the Fed. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is Kathleen Hayes. This is Hayes Advantage on Bloomberg Radio.
Good to be with you.
Listen to the Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM satellite radio channel 113. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.